This is an ABC podcast.
I'm Jonathan Green. This is Lost and Found. This week, on trees. Sophie Cunningham is an author. Her new book is City of Trees, essays on life, death, and the need for a forest.
I wanted to talk about a mountain ash called Ada, which is the largest mountain ash in Victoria. She, I'll use it, that pronoun, comes from the Yarra Ranges, I think the Yarra Valley, and you can actually do a walk. It's called the Ada Walk if you're looking for it. She's about 400 years old, and one of the things that's really significant about mountain ash is just how they just have these long kind of draping kind of bark. It can drop 30 metres of bark, so it looked to me a bit like a cloak. And the tree used to be dramatically taller than it currently is, and it sort of lost its crown in a fairly major storm, which is quite common. And one of the things I love about big old trees is the way they sort of look elegant from one angle, but you can start to see how time and weather has really played against them, and she's looking a bit raggedy up the top.
How does it feel in her presence?
You do feel awestruck, partly because the walk itself is very beautiful and you're walking through remnant rainforest. There's not much this sort of really temperate or cool rainforest. So it's all sort of dark and green, and then you come out and it's much more open, and then there's these massive trees. Mountain ash are really significant. There are a lot of them in Tasmania as well. And, of course, they're being discussed a lot in various debates around logging. They are habitat for leadbeater's possums, for gliders, and they also affect the quality of our water. So they're really important for Melbourne having a good water supply. And they do a lot of carbon, they hold a lot of carbon.
And their forests have a real sort of structural air. It's like a cathedral, a real vaulted space.
Often really giant trees do have that. You do feel like you're in a cathedral.
Sunday morning, skeleton tree. Oh, nothing is for free.
John McGuire is the Managing Director, Built Environment at Oricon. John, we've had a lot of buildings in the past 100 years or so constructed from steel. Are we moving towards a century that might be marked by timber construction?
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan, and that's a really great question. If you look back through history, from the earliest days of habitation, mankind has used timber and trees as a basis for creating shelters, whether that's a lean-to shelter, to a log cabin, to even what we use today in residential construction. Timber's used quite regularly and frequently for timber framing, gangnail trusses. But in recent times, what's been really interesting is that we've seen advances in the technologies around the manufacturing process of a timber and how you can create much, much stronger timber elements that's now allowing timber construction to come into more commercial, heavy load, and even high-rise buildings. So this is quite an exciting time because you're right. Throughout history, for the last 100 years, it has been, in commercial buildings, it's been dominated by concrete and steel. And so this almost reinvention of an original material into commercial uses is actually really exciting.
And the breakthrough idea in this that makes this sort of bigness possible is cross-laminated timber. Can you explain what that is for us?
So if you can imagine, timber breaks quite easy along its grain, and most people would know and understand that, but it's very difficult to break it across the grain. And so cross-laminated timber is getting basically sheets of timber, put it fundamentally 90 degrees to each other, glued together with specific types of adhesives, and then put under pressure and treated. And by doing so, you can actually increase the strength of a timber element, whether that's a beam or a column, to now have almost an equivalent level of strength to what you'd expect from, you know, a concrete and steel. And so this new manufacturing process has unlocked that potential. Part of that has been the types of glues that are now used, which are now non-toxic, they're not doing off-gassing and are allowing much better adhesion under pressure. So this manufacturing process has opened up the gambit for timber to a much, much wider set of applications, which is fantastic.
We know that the production of concrete is one of the more environmentally destructive things that we do as a species. With the creation of cross-laminated timber, what's its environmental footprint?
You know, the construction industry and manufacturers from all types of materials have been looking at reducing the carbon footprint of their material, whether it's steel through recycled steel or whether it's through a concrete with different forms and blends of concrete. But you're right. You're absolutely 100% correct. You know, a lot of carbon is used. Whereas with timber, you know, it is a completely renewable resource. And in fact, as you grow timber or trees, you're sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere. So this is actually pulling carbon out as you're growing it, and it's fully renewable. So that has a massive impact by comparison to some of the other materials on the embodied energy and the embodied carbon content that goes into major building construction.
Fire risk in an exclusively timber-constructed tall building?
Yeah. Look, great question, and that's a question that people will often ask, and of course, everybody knows that timber is flammable. but again, when you tightly pack a material, as tightly packed as what cross-laminated timber is, or LVL as well, put it under pressure, then what happens is that the burn rate is very controlled. And mostly it is limited to the outer surface, because for things to burn, you actually need oxygen. And what happens is that as that outer surface chars with oxygen, that forms a protective coat for the inner layers of the timber. And so when we design columns and beams, we design for that inner strength, noting that there is a char rate, at which point in time that becomes fully carbonized and it ceases to burn. So there's been a lot of research and a lot of advances done on this. And whilst it might seem counterintuitive, this is what the research has shown. So engineers are very confident with how these buildings will now perform under a fire load.
Listeners who might be keen to pop out and have a look at a tall timber construction, where would they head?
Well, Oricon has just recently moved into our own new head office in Brisbane, at 25 King Street, which is an 11-storey building, fully constructed out of timber. And the interesting thing with that is that every single element of that building, other than its first floor slab, is done out of timber. And what's interesting about that is, as you get taller in a building, not only do you have vertical loads, the forces coming down, but you have lateral loads, so wind blowing on a building, wanting the building to push over. And so from an engineering point of view, what we have to do is we have to stop that. We have to brace the building. And typically we brace a building through elements like staircases and lift cores and whatnot. And typically that is done in concrete. The interesting thing with the 25 King Street building is all of the building construction, both the vertical and the lateral loads, are fully taking up in a timber design. So this is a 100% timber building, other than the first floor slab, which is concrete.
John, thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. It was great to talk to you.
John Maguire.
I think the most struck I've been by any tree in the world that I've seen has been in the giant sequoia in the Sierra of California. They are the biggest trees in the world, even though, of course, there's endless nerdy discussion about how you define biggest tree in the world. But they're so big, it's possibly like swimming with whales or climbing Mount Everest. You kind of lose any sense of perspective. And I talked about Ada's, the crown on the mountain ash, the giant sequoia. It's pretty hard to see the crowns on the giant sequoia. And they're kind of fabulous because they've got very thick, spongy red bark. Redwoods is a colloquial name for them. You can kind of lean into them and they're soft. But if you look up, they kind of look like they've got a sort of bad bowl cut on top. But in fact, those crowns are entire cities in themselves. They have extraordinary number of animals, insects and other plants living in them. But I couldn't get anywhere close to seeing what they looked like. There are not many of the giant sequoia left. They're being particularly affected by climate change because they can't, they can't just keep growing upwards, as in the mountains aren't high enough, the Sierra aren't high enough for them to kind of escape the general pressures of drought and heat. So they're also the oldest trees in the world, some of the oldest trees in the world. They're really, really very special.
The green plastic watering can.
Dr. Judy Bush is a postdoctoral research fellow from the Clean Air and Urban Landscapes Hub at the University of Melbourne. Judy, you have been involved in the planting of 1 million trees.
Hi, Jonathan. I haven't actually planted any of those million trees, but I've watched on with great delight and enthusiasm for the amazing work that Greening the West has achieved in planting those million trees throughout Melbourne's west.
This is something of a transformative project. I mean, a million trees, that makes a big impression on an area.
Yes, it does. And certainly the west of Melbourne, post-industrial landscape, was due for a big injection of tree cover and tree canopy into their area. So, yes, we hope it will be transformative.
Even pre-industrial, and this is the interesting thing, this is a part of the landscape, part of the basalt plain, which takes up most of Western Victoria. It's not a very tree-y place.
No, that's entirely true. It's actually not only is the original soil of the area difficult for trees to grow in because it's heavy basalt clay, it was, as you say, it was native grassland, sweeping plains of native grassland.
Which is another story altogether, the
indeed
amount of that's left.
But yeah, as well as the soil being difficult, the area west of Melbourne is also a rain shadow, so it gets significantly less rainfall than, for example, areas in the east around the Dandenong Ranges and so on. So potentially it's much harder for trees to grow in that area. With urbanisation, of course, we're changing the soils and so on. And so there are opportunities, if we're planting houses, to be actually planting trees with the urbanisation processes.
Which is an interesting thing. Yes, that urbanisation has, in a sense, improved that environment for the likes of trees. They can grow a bit better now.
Potentially. And one of the elements that I'm really interested in with Greening the West's 1 million trees is that there's now 1 million opportunities for residents of the West to actually connect with trees. Mm. And maybe the residents of the West can take a caring, a custodial role with those trees and actually water the trees, make up for the lack of rain by actually adopting a tree and keeping an eye on those new baby trees that have been established.
We've seen too in various projects that yes, people are keen to develop those relationships.
Yes. When I talk to people about trees, people often have stories of particular trees that they love. And one of the things I think is really interesting is that people connect on a range of through a range of different senses. So people talk about the sound of trees, not just the look of trees, but the sound of trees. I really love that idea.
And this too, for people cultivating a sense of place where they live, this is important because there's so much about suburbia, which is reasonably anonymous, that it's hard to develop that affinity. But introducing nature to that, suddenly it begins to change.
Yes, I think nature is a really important element in the way that we develop that sense of place and then connection with place. And I think also projects like Greening the Wests that involve tree planting are a great opportunity for people to actually participate and actually meet others who are in their local area who also want to see more trees in their local area.
How long did it take to get 1 million trees in?
It took, I think, Greening the West worked with a whole range of collaborators, so good on them.
Yep.
I think they received their funding in 2015 and they planted their millionth tree late 2018, so 3 years.
There's so much that's sort of reassuring about this as an idea and as a practice, that there were 1 million little trees that could be planted is a tremendous thing in itself.
Yes, indeed. And I think it's interesting, the UN has declared that the decade from 2021 will be the decade of ecosystem restoration. So here's Greening the West and other groups around Melbourne and Australia who actually have got a head start on that process?
Because we know what trees do. We know what that trees can have a cooling effect on urban environments that, you know, and that's the, perhaps the least of their very many virtues. Mm. What kind of trees are involved in these million in greening the West?
I think they've put in a range of different species depending on the different locations that they've put them in. So some of them are street trees and they're, as you say, really important for cooling the urban area and also for just giving shade on hot days so that people can actually step out of their houses or their apartments and travel to places that they need to be during those heat waves. So there are different species of trees that are going to be better suited for street planting, and then a lot of the trees also went into parkland areas. Some of those will be indigenous species that can then provide habitat to a whole range of different species, birds, insects and so on.
I wonder who counted the million trees. They had a little clicker.
That's what accountants are good for, probably.
Judy, thank you.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.
Judy Bush. It wears me out. It wears me out.
The next tree I want to talk about has a name. That name is Tane Mahuta. Tane Mahuta, he is referred to as a he in all the signage, is a giant kauri from Northland in New Zealand. The giant kauri of New Zealand are really extraordinary looking trees. They've sort of got spotted bark. They're very different looking to trees that I knew, big trees I knew from Australia. And they sort of, some of them are very, they're very big, but sometimes because they're very wide, they're not necessarily super tall. They're also often covered in epiphytes and other plants. So there's almost like there's a forest in the forest up above them, above you, I mean. And they are dying at the moment because of fungal attack. And there's been lots of debate in New Zealand about how best to manage that and whether to cut tourists. To go and visit Tane Mahuta, you need to wash your boots and on the way in and the way out to try and stop the fungal spores travelling. But it's not totally clear if that's going to stop the problem. The fungus gets in through the roots and the trees are dying quite quickly. There are some things that are being done which seem to be making a difference. So I think we just have to hope.
Jamie Lewis is a City of Darwin Technical Officer in the Parks and Reserves Management Area. Jamie, you recently in Darwin lost a very significant tree.
We've actually lost several as a result of Cyclone Marcus and a few for other various reasons as well.
One of your heritage listed trees has also reached the end of its natural life?
That would be probably the Milkwood in Falls Street in the CBD, which is a shame to see that one go.
How old was that tree, do you think?
It most likely predated white settlement of the Darwin Peninsula, so potentially, you know, 100 years plus.
How many other heritage listed trees like that in the Darwin area?
On par with that one, we've probably only got another, say, half a dozen that would be as significant as that one.
And some of them sort of pop up in the strangest of places.
We've got a significant baobab in the middle of a car park, and we've got a banyan tree, the Tree of Knowledge, which is actually located inside the Civic Centre Gardens. So some of them are in rather unusual spots.
Heritage listing for a tree is an interesting thing. What's the importance of that heritage listing and how does that protect the tree?
Look, the importance of it is that trees are obviously things that outlive humans. They provide great linkages back to the past. They're a great reminder of where we've been and where we've come from. And they're also assets that we can maintain into the future so we don't lose those linkages. Having them heritage listed basically provides some protection around development that happens around trees and some recommendations and guidelines on how we manage those trees going forward.
It's in some ways a great place for things to grow up in the tropics, but in others a destructive environment. Cyclones must take a terrible toll on trees.
Cyclones do, and also just our climate. You know, we normally have 4 months of flooding and 8 months of drought up here. So that's a hard environment for a tree to survive in as well. Not to mention also that a lot of our heritage listed trees are in the urban environment, so there's always conflicts with infrastructure and surrounding land use as well that compounds that.
So we've just had the loss, as you say, of that Milkwood tree, a heritage listed tree that predated European settlement. Can you describe the location of that tree for us?
So the tree was actually located on private property on a vacant block in the CBD that formerly housed a block of units. They've since been demolished, and it was adjacent to Council Road Reserve, but the tree was located on private property. And certainly the development that has happened on the private property over the years has probably played a role in its decline, but certainly not the only cause.
It's a great survivor, you'd have to say.
Yeah, Milkwoods generally are. They're a pretty hardy tree, but it was getting towards the end of its life, and it is in a pretty hard location for any tree to survive.
And Milkwoods were once pretty typical around the Darwin Peninsula?
Oh, yeah, they're nearly an iconic top-end species. We actually plant quite a few Milkwoods every year. They're one of our preferred species, so they're definitely a good Darwin local tree. Pretty good representation of what's typical in the countryside up here.
Can you describe them to us, the Milkwood, for the southern listener?
Yeah, cool. So they're a large tree, gets to about 20 metres, has a light-coloured corky bark, little pale green leaves. The flower is pretty innocuous. You're probably not likely to spot it. Their main feature is their trunk, which is a big, broad, corky, nearly architectural-looking thing. They're a beautiful tree. They're not flamboyant by any means, but they're just a really nice, sturdy, stable tree to have around. It grows to a pretty considerable size.
It's tremendous that lots of them are now being planted, and that will, you know, future generations will be able to enjoy those magnificent trees.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the plan. We're really trying to take a strategic approach to our tree planting so that we do have, you know, good value urban forest to pass on for generations into the future.
Jamie, thanks so much.
No, you're welcome.
Jamie Lewis.
Olives are famously trees that you find through Italy and Spain. I was in Puglia last year, and that's got, I think, the largest number of millennial trees in the world. That is, trees that are more than 1,000 years old. There was a grove where apparently the olive trees were 2,000 years old. These numbers do get flung around, and you're never quite sure whether the trees really are 2,000 years old, but suffice to say they are very, very, very old and gnarled. They look like something out of a children's fairy tale. They look like goblins. They're not very productive anymore. That is, not many olives grow on them, and they have a lot of buttressing, like an old person, you know, they're kind of like their sticks and corsets, and the farmers aren't allowed to remove them from their land because they have such heritage value, which puts them in a tricky position because they're not very productive trees. These trees have been disappearing and turning up in the gardens of wealthy Italians to the north. So they're now geotagging trees to try and keep track of them. I assume that sometimes the trees are stolen because they're worth quite a lot, because they have these kind of quality which people try and whack in their garden further north. But it's also possible that sometimes it's done with the permission of the farmer, the unofficial permission of the farmer, so that they can plant younger olive groves and start producing more olive oil.
With a 1,000-year-old or 2,000-year-old olive tree, is there a sense that that's naturally occurring, or was that once upon a time planted by someone for olives?
It is naturally occurring. That is, quite a few trees, types of trees, can live that long. What's changing is that trees are no longer living so long. So, in fact, it probably won't continue to be the case that trees will live for as long, for all the reasons that development, climate change, policy change, logging, views on logging, views on development. There might be sort of five changes of policies over a 50-year period, and as we've been discussing, these trees live for thousands of years, so that kind of different timescales, totally different timescales.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production this week on trees. You heard from Sophie Cunningham, author, City of Trees, John Maguire, Managing Director of Built Environment at Oricon, Dr. Judy Bush, Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the Clean Air and Urban Landscapes Hub at the University of Melbourne, and James Lewis, City of Darwin Technical Officer in the Parks and Reserves Management Area. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Melissa May. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.